Welcome to Richer Life. Our goal is to help you drive more money, motivation, and meaning into your life. Today I'm having a conversation with Dr. BJ Fogg. We're going to talk about one of my absolute favorite topics in the world, and that is how we can change our behavior. So BJ is a professor at Stanford University, and he also founded the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab. He's the author of several books, including Persuasive Technology, Using Computers to Change What We Think and Do. So BJ, thank you so much for coming on here and talking about one of my favorite topics, and I know one of the topics that my audience just loves to listen.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So you have dedicated a great deal of your professional life and research in trying to answer the question, how can people change their behavior? And so if you walk into any bookstore, go down any aisle, whether it's self-help, nutrition, weight loss, whatever it is, they're all trying to answer really that same question. How can we get people to change their behavior? And so you've created this model. It's called the Fogg Behavior Model, FBM. And so what is this model, what is it really trying to tell us?
Well, the model breaks behavior down into three elements. And those three elements apply to any kind of behavior change that happens. And the three things are motivation. In order to do something, you have to have some level of motivation. The second one is ability. You have to have the ability to do it. And the third one is trigger. Now, the trigger is the call to action. It's a thing that says, do it now. Now, in the model, and this, I think, is a unique contribution of my model, it's all three things have to come together at the same moment for someone to do a behavior. So, for example, let's say I'm calling my mom. Say that's the behavior. I have the motivation to call my mom, and I have the ability, but until the trigger happens, it might be some sort of reminder, or I read something that, makes me think I should call my mom right now, or maybe my sister calls and says, hey, you really should call mom. So it's the call to action. But it has to happen when I have the ability and the motivation. So it's those three things happening at once that describe, I think, all behaviors.
And so the interesting thing is that if there's a behavior that we are not doing, that maybe we have some interest in wanting to do, that we have to somehow, I don't know if manipulate's the right word, but somehow control for these three things, whether it's increasing our motivation, increasing our ability, or setting up these triggers. Would that be correct?
Exactly. And the thing that is counterintuitive, in other words, the thing that is not obvious, it certainly wasn't obvious to me, and I wish I had known this 10 years ago, is when there's a behavior you want to do, let's say that you want to, go to the gym every day. The first thing, if you're not doing that behavior, the first thing to focus on is triggers. Am I reminding myself? Do I have something on my calendar that reminds me? Do I have a friend that's calling me? Do I have something that's saying go to the gym now? So you look at triggers first. The next thing you look at is ability. Do I have the ability to do this? And third is when you worry about motivation. Now that's the opposite of what regular intuition would suggest and what other people are suggesting. But that turns out to be the right troubleshooting sequence for any behavior you want to create in your life that's not happening. Set up the triggers and then make sure the behavior is easy enough. You know, if the gym's 2 hours away, that's hard to do, and maybe you should just do 3 push-ups right there in the living room rather than going to the gym. And often something like motivation isn't the missing factor, especially for something like getting healthier. We have a lot of built-in motivation to get healthier. So it's really focused on triggers and then make the behavior easy enough to do.
Interesting, because like you said, intuition would say, well, of course, you start with motivation. Once you're motivated, boy, you're going to want to learn the ability. You're going to want to set up these triggers. But you're saying, of course, it's just the opposite. Let's say you have the triggers set up and you have the ability, and let's say it's going to the gym. It's easy to go to the gym. It's just a couple of miles away, and you've got your cell phone set up to remind you, okay, it's, 5:15, it's time to go to the gym. Yet, you're driving home and you're thinking, I just don't feel like it. Isn't that the motivation? How do we motivate ourselves to want to go to the gym?
Well, see, and I would still, in that scenario, I would still focus on the behavior itself, the ability factor. And instead of saying, oh, I have to go to the gym and work out for an hour, if you set up what the behavior I want is, all I have to do is walk into the gym, and that's it. And so as you're driving home, it's like, you know, I don't feel like working out, but the behavior is just stop walking to the gym, and I can walk out if I need to, or if I don't feel like it. So it's scaling the behavior back to something so simple that you don't have to amp up your motivation to get it done. Now, what will often happen when you do that little baby step, like, well, I'm going to do my body, you know, get dressed and work out for a few minutes. And once you do the first thing, let me give a slightly different example. In writing books, in writing a dissertation, when it's like, oh, I don't want to, you know, write it today, if you just get yourself to write two sentences, that often leads to writing much longer. If you think I have to write for 2 hours, you'll come up with all sorts of excuses. In other words, again, I wouldn't focus on the motivation aspect as much what's the smallest behavior that matters in this case. And it might be, all I have to do is go to the gym parking lot. And then at that point, if I want to go home, fine. In another context, I am advising people to floss one tooth as a way of creating flossing as a habit. If you think, oh, I have to floss all my teeth, you might get busy and you might, you know, you may not do it, but flossing one tooth is so simple. The point there is if you can create that as a habit, flossing one tooth, and that little, what I'm calling a tiny habit, will expand to the full habit, which is flossing all your teeth. So it's a different way of thinking about behavior, and it really does focus on what's the trigger and the behavior really simple. And then what's it? That simple habit will then expand to the full behavior that you want without really amping up the motivation.
And so what it sounds like you're doing is you're really focusing on the ability, making whatever the behavior is so simple and so easy that because of that, it requires such little motivation. Is that kind of what you're doing?
Right. And when you look at the frog behavior model, motivation and ability are on different axes. And if something's very simple to do, the motivation can be low and you'll still do it. But if it's hard to do, the motivation has to be high in order to do it. So where you really want to focus on is make it so easy that the motivation can be high, it can be low, whatever, but it's easy to do, so you still do it. In fact, defaults. When you set up a default on your computer or when a company sets up a default for you, what they're doing is making it so easy to do. They're making it hard not to do that thing. And in some ways, the motivation can be extremely low because it's so easy. It's the default. You still do it. You have to work not to do it. So it's that kind of thinking around behavior that I think is unusual. But when you look at the model and you look at the implications of the model, it's like, oh, well, there it is. Just make it really easy to do. And trust that over time, the more you do it, the easier the behavior gets. So the more you walk for 3 minutes a day, the easier a 10-minute walk or a 30-minute walk or a 60-minute walk gets. So the behavior then becomes easier to do, even if your motivation level doesn't change. So you're capable of doing more with less motivation.
Right. So the great takeaway here is then if there's a behavior that you haven't been doing that you really want to start doing, is to really take that behavior and minimize it. Try to find the smallest thing that you could do. And as a result of that, it requires very little motivation.
Yeah, and let me give an example in the financial management space. So, you know, there's some things I'm good at and some things I'm not. And one of them is I'm not that interested in just getting out my checkbook and paying bills. It's not that fun. But I do put it on my calendar when I need to do it. And when that time comes, if I don't want to sit down and pay all my bills, spend the 30 minutes or 45 minutes to do that, all I do is I get out the drawer with all the bills and I go put it on the kitchen counter. That's all I do. I just take out the drawer, I stick there, and it's like, I'm done. And that's enough. But see, that drawer, taking out the drawer and getting the bills out in front of me, then leads to the other behaviors, you know, sort of a chaining of behaviors that happens. And so if you can get something to do the next step, then often it gets a lot easier to keep going, and you're paying all your bills, and it's like, you know, you're done. Now the behavior model also works for behaviors you don't want to do. So if you look at a behavior you don't want to do, let's pick an obvious one, like that might be too much. Smoking is a really tough behavior, so we'll just pick that one. Motivation ability triggers. If you want to stop a behavior, you need to remove one of those elements. Remove motivation, remove ability, remove the trigger. And if you remove any one of those elements, the behavior will also stop. Example from my own life is eating popcorn. I eat way too much popcorn. I have this little glass popcorn pop you sit in the microwave and all that. But I really eat a lot of popcorn.
That's pretty funny.
I know it sounds funny to people, but when you eat a lot of popcorn, I mean, anything can become an obsession. And one way to eat less popcorn is to not buy it. So you take away the ability factor. Or to not be in a situation where it gets triggered. This is like, oh, let's watch a movie on TV. That let's watch a movie concept then triggers, oh, let's get popcorn. So I don't really focus on demotivating myself. It's like, let's take away the ability. There's been popcorn poppers I've thrown away, or there's times when I don't buy any popcorn and make sure there's no popcorn in the house, right? I think everyone can think of habits or behaviors in their own life where this is applied. You know, where people often just try to motivate themselves out of the behavior. If you take away the trigger, or if you take away the ability, then it's a more predictable way, I think, of designing for behavior change.
And so you can be at home watching a movie. That's the trigger. You're motivated. You want popcorn, but you've removed the ability because you don't have any popcorn.
Right. Or another way to remove the ability is to do what I call a blocking behavior. So I go and chop up a bunch of celery into small bits, and I eat celery instead. So while I'm eating celery, I can't also eat, I guess I could. But, you know, it's celery eating blocking the other behavior. Now, as we talk about behavior and behavior change, in the behavior grid that we've mapped out, there are 15 types of behavior. And right now we're kind of clumping them together. We're going from behaviors that are habits, you know, creating and sustaining habits, to a behavior type that's about stopping a habit. Now, those are, you know, recognize, and I know you do, but, you know, people listen to this, recognize those are different types of behaviors. One's about I'm creating a habit, and one's I'm breaking a habit, and those require different formulas. But the FOG behavior model applies to both of them, in that you always have motivation, ability, trigger. Those are the three elements. Three factors at play.
And so one of the things I really liked about your approach is that what you just said, there are different formulas for changing behavior, whether it's starting a behavior once, you call those dots, doing a behavior over time, those are paths, or doing it for a shorter period of time, those are dashes. And so you can, it's really great because you can kind of plug in, figure out what the behavior is that you either want to do or stop doing, and really figure out which of these three elements, whether it's motivation, ability, or trigger, that you really need to manipulate and how you need to do it in order for that behavior to come about. And so it's very, very simple, and I've not seen this before in anything I've ever read or heard. And that's what I found it just so fascinating, because there really is almost a formula to this. And one of the things that you also have written about is how you can create a habit for yourself. And you break it down into three very, very simple steps. And the first one is kind of one that we've already talked about, but it's to make it tiny. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when you ask people, you know, what behavior do you want in your life, people often want to create some sort of habit, some healthy habit or some habit around financial security or something like that. And if you tackle something that's too big, and we've all done it before, it just, when it's too big and hard and the motivation drops, you don't do it, and then you're like, oh, I'm, you know, I broke the chain, I'm not doing it, I'm bad at this. And it actually hurts your ability to change in the future. But if you make it super simple, like so simple that you can do it, I think there's something magical about those baby steps, succeeding at small little steps, and having success lead to larger success. So I think, as you know, I'm a big fan of flossing. I mean, I love flossing.
Well, it's all that popcorn you're eating, VJ.
Yeah, I didn't love flossing 3 years ago, and I think I was like most people where you go to the dentist and, you know, and get the cleaning done on your teeth, and the hygienist would say, are you flossing? And, you know, maybe right, you know, a few days before the appointment.
Yeah, right.
But they know you're not flossing. And so then you go home and you floss with you and you forget. Well, the secret there, and I think this applies to many types of daily habits, is to pick the smallest behavior that matters. Make it tiny. And in this case, flossing one tooth. The second step is to find where that fits into your daily schedule. So whether it's, you know, I'm going to walk every day after my lunch break, I'm going to call my mom every day after I get home, I'm going to text my sister every day as soon as I arrive at the gym. Find where it fits. Flossing fits naturally right after you brush. And so I brush twice a day, so I floss twice a day. So I floss one tooth twice a day, and you, if you don't have flossing as a habit, what you focus on is not flossing all your teeth, but training the cycle. That brushing automatically leads to flossing. So brushing is the trigger to flossing. So as you brush, as you finish, then it's the trigger that says, oh, floss, it's really easy to do. You might not have a lot of motivation because it's so easy to do. So it's getting that to be automatic, a habit as I see it. The strength of a habit can be measured by how automatic it is in your life. And so if you have to decide, am I going to floss or not, it's not a very strong habit, but if it happens without thinking, then it is. So, and one of the hypotheses, and we haven't proven this scientifically, but I do think it's true, and we'll be working on some experiments, some research around this, is once you get that small habit set, floss one tooth, that small habit will expand naturally to the full habit, which is flossing all your teeth without any outside intervention. That there's a natural size for a behavior, exercise 30 minutes, floss all your teeth, and that if you can get the tiny habit created, that it will naturally grow to the right size.
And this is because, what, you're already committed? Like, you've taken all of the bills and you've put them on the table, or you've written the two sentences. You've shown up at the gym. Is it because you're already there that you just kind of think, all right, well, I've got this far, might as well just keep going?
Yeah, I think when it comes to daily habits, I think the culture has an expectation that you're going to exercise, it should be at least 30 minutes, you're going to floss, it should be all your teeth. So we already have built into us kind of a cultural expectation of what that full behavior is like. Now, notice this also works for bad habits. If you have a tiny bad habit and you're in an environment that allows that to be a much larger bad habit, that will eventually become the large bad habit. For example, let's say a student ends up getting assigned to a dorm that's kind of a party dorm where they drink a lot. Say they drink every night. If that student's not a drinker, but then says, oh, I'm going to just have, you know, a sip every night and what have you, and that becomes a habit, that student will then, with time, be partying just like all the others, because that's what the context, that's what the social norm of behavior is. So habit formation, I think these steps cut both ways.
And so the real important thing here, when you're trying to come up with a new habit, is to summarize, is one, you've got to make it tiny, and you use the phrase, the smallest behavior that matters, whatever that might be. It might be writing the two sentences. It might be putting the bills on the table. It might be just driving to the gym. Whatever it is, it's the smallest behavior that matters. And the second thing is to find a spot, and you're saying find a spot in the day, and you've talked before about it's really important, if you can, to sort of place that new habit that you're trying to form after an already existing strong habit. Now, why is that important?
Yeah.
Is it because you're trying to pair the two together to make it almost seamless?
Yeah, well, we talked about triggers earlier. The already existing behavior, like brushing, becomes the trigger for the new habit. So you don't have to send yourself a text message or put up a post-it note to remind you. You train yourself so the previous behavior, the existing behavior, triggers the next one. And as you look at habits you already have in your life, that's how it works. If you look at your morning routine, most of us have things we do in a sequence. You know, one thing then triggers the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. Now, we weren't born with that sequence. We developed it over time. And when we get caught out of sequence, we forget stuff. So we kind of mess up, you know? So notice how this has already worked in your life and then design new habits into it. So finding the right place where it fits, you've got to have the time to do whatever it is. But so there's a natural connection. So right now, one of the habits I have is I get up, and the first thing I do in the morning is I drink a big glass of water. And that's the connection. So getting up, getting out of bed, walking out of the bedroom to the kitchen, then trigger getting the water.
And is it at this point a pretty strong habit? Do you even have to think about it anymore?
Nope. In fact, if I didn't do it, I would just feel like something's missing, something's wrong.
And so if you wanted then to add a new habit, what you would do is then pair it after having the drink of water.
Yep. And you'd have to work on that for a little while. You know, after the drink water, then I do this. But eventually it becomes automatic. You don't even think about it. And again, it has to be simple. If it's, you know, I drink water and then I go running for an hour, getting that part of behavior to form, that would be really hard. But if it, you know, take a glass of water and then do, do one push-up. Yeah, I could do that. It's just one push-up.
With, of course, the idea that eventually you'd be doing more than one push-up.
Yeah. As you get stronger, as your ability increases, then it gets easier to do 2 and 5 and 10 and what have you. So it's this kind of thinking about behavior, you know, breaking it back, motivation, ability, trigger. And then when it's about habit formation, understanding how habits form, for better or worse. And then being, you know, have to be a little bit thoughtful about designing new behaviors into your life. But it's not as hard as most people think when you take that approach.
Well, I liked what you said about designing new behaviors, because I think for a lot of us, the behaviors we have were not consciously designed. They just sort of have happened. And so when you approach it this way, you actually have much more control over your behavior, because you're consciously making the decision. I want to start doing these new behaviors, increase this behavior, or maybe stop doing this behavior. And so design is really, really key here. And so we just have a few more minutes, but I'm hoping we can just sort of burn through these top 10 mistakes in behavior change, because they're just so, I think for a lot of people, they think, well, yeah, that makes sense, but it's actually a mistake. And so the first one, we've kind of touched on it, it's relying on willpower for long-term change. And why is that a mistake?
Well, I think, you know, your willpower will go up and down. And some researchers have presented some compelling evidence that willpower is like a muscle, and if you use it too much, you run out of the ability to use it. So as willpower lags, you won't be able to do the behavior. So instead, make the behavior simpler so it doesn't require that much willpower. And then you develop your capability. So as you do something over and over, you change, like, say, going to the gym, you figure out where's my gym clothes, where do I park, all that. So it's not about willpower. It's about redesigning your life, the context around you. And so in that mistake, one of the suggestions is forget that willpower exists and, you know, design a solution as though there's no such thing as willpower. And that leads you to a better answer.
It's interesting. I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking you can also set up a series of triggers. So, for example, you want to work out every day. That's great. And so you have a habit of brushing and flossing your teeth every single night. And so the trigger would be, okay, let's pack my gym bag. And that would be the trigger would be brushing the teeth. The packing the gym bag would be the new behavior. You would put that gym bag right outside, you know, maybe your bedroom door. And so when you wake up in the morning and you're going downstairs, that's a new trigger because the gym bag is there. And then maybe you have it set up or you text yourself or set up some sort of a text reminder at 5:15 that, all right, it's time to go to the gym. Is that kind of practically how these things happen?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And I think the solution is different for each person because the situations are different. Me, for example, if I pick up my gym bag and my car keys, I will be working out for at least 30 minutes because there's, and we call these domino actions. So as I do that action, then there's a domino effect that leads all the way to me working out at the gym because there's nothing that gets me off that path. So if you can understand what the sequence of actions is and how to go upstream up the domino chain and trigger the right one upstream, then the subsequent actions trigger each other all the way down.
Right. So the domino here would be you pick up your gym bag, your car keys, and driving to the gym is already taken care of. Finding a parking spot, changing the clothes, getting the workout gloves. And those are the dominoes you're talking about that just automatically fall once you have your gym bag and your car keys?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I know we've covered things that are a little bit abstract and it might sound complicated, but if what I've found, and I do this in my persuasion boot camps and in the short phone calls I do, if people just stop and think for a little bit about trigger ability motivation and they think about behaviors and behavior sequences, it really gets pretty simple to think through those things and then to understand where's my opportunity to trigger the right behavior at the right moment. So, you know, maybe for some people it's putting the gym bag outside the door, others it's, you know, sending me a text message at 5:15 you go to the gym. It's going to be different for each person, but you can think it through and you can design systems to get the behavior to happen. And if something you try doesn't work, try something else.
Right. Do something different. That's always a good answer. When something's not working, just try something different.
And what you shouldn't do is beat yourself up for not doing it. Say, well, I didn't find the right little thing to tweak. It wasn't about the gym bag, so let me try text message. If that fails a couple of times, great, let's find something else. So in other words, don't blame yourself and your lack of motivation. Instead, it's sort of like a puzzle to solve.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
What's the trigger? What's the trigger and how do I make it simple enough? And you're searching for the solution. And it really, most of our behaviors and behavior changes have very little to do with manipulating motivation. That's the reality.
That is just such a comment, because that's what we're all trying to manipulate, is our motivation, trying to increase our willpower. And it's hard, and this is why we have 1,000 self-help books published every year, because it's really hard to manipulate our motivation. But if you start manipulating your environment, the context, or these triggers, that seems like it's a whole lot easier to me.
Yeah, exactly. So motivation, it can go up and down, it can change moment by moment, but if you've made something easier to do, that factor is more stable. In other words, it's a much better investment to make the working out behavior simpler to do than trying to watch videos or put pictures on your fridge about people in shape. So it's between ability and motivation, it's ability, it's simplicity that changes behavior. Not motivated.
Interesting. So the picture on the fridge of, the person in shape not going to help as much as really creating those triggers or making the ability a whole lot easier.
So I think when the picture on the fridge does work, it's not working because it's a motivator.
It's a trigger, right.
It's saying, boom, eat vegetables now, rather than, so I've not said this, but I would put money on it that things that traditionally were viewed as motivators, when they worked, they actually worked because they were triggers.
That is interesting. I'm seeing some research coming out of this.
You know, there's so many interesting things to be discovered in this arena. And again, I think if people can discover them on their own as they think about, here's the behavior, what was the motivator, what was the ability element, and how did they get triggered? What was the call to action? As you start seeing the world in that way, things get a lot clearer. Your own behavior of customers, people around you, and so on.
And we'll do a couple more of these top 10 mistakes, because then I'll write about them as well. But this other one is really important. It's that believing that information leads to action, and that you would think that if we simply have the information that, you know, we're intellectual people, right? We're rational, that we would figure out what we need to do. But, of course, that simply doesn't work. This is why we have, self-help books and personal finance books all saying the same thing year after year. It's a very simple what we need to do. So it's not the information. What is it then?
I think it's the secret to behavior change is triggering the right sequence of baby steps. So if you can trigger the right sequence of baby steps, I think you can change your own behavior or other behavior in miraculous ways. Now, it's easy to say, trigger the right sequence of baby steps, but it's actually a little more difficult to figure it out for, you know, hard behaviors like quitting smoking and so on. Going back to the mistaken behavior changes, information leads to behavior. You know, people in the health arena have made this mistake over and over and over. They just think if we just put the information on the website, then people will do the right health behavior. If we just let them visualize it, the broken links in that are the assumption that information then leads to attitude change, and then attitude change will then lead to behavior change. So those are two gaps. Neither one of those gaps gets filled very well. Information only leads to attitude change, and people believe what they want to believe. So if you read something that you don't want to believe, it will tend not to change your opinion. And that opinions or attitudes lead to behavior change is also a very slippery connection. So what what I'm trying to call out is information is not the solution to behavior change. Now, when it comes to making decisions, a one-time decision that has a lot at stake, like where to invest money or what cancer treatment to get, that's the case where information does lead to behavior. But that's only one of 15 types of behavior change. And all the other types, it doesn't work.
Information is simply not enough. And this is why, of course, you know, when you're watching TV at night and all of a sudden the PETA comes on or the Humane Association, they're not, you know, discussing all the statistics or all the information on the cruelty to animals. They show you a video that's very, very powerful. It's very emotional. And what is the rationale there? Because they're not using information, but they're still, of course, trying to get you to change your behavior. That is, i.e., pick up the phone and donate.
Yeah. Now, notice in those kinds of things that there's a call to action. There's a trigger and something you can do right now. If there's not, it fails. If they just show you an emotional video about, you know, animals and how to, you know, our stewardship of animals, there's no call to action. Or if you can't do it right then, it's ineffective. So the secret, so it's not as much about the video and manipulating emotions. Now is a good time to call us. So I yes, they are amping up the motivation through the video, but then there's a clear call to action. So we're calling that, it's a whole other topic, but there's a concept that we're talking about more and more in my lab. We call it motivation wave. That's when the motivation is high. And when what it also implies is the motivation wave will subside.
Yeah, right.
So when the wave is there, that's when to make the call to action. And what they're doing in the video is temporarily creating a little tiny wave, hopefully getting you over the threshold to do the behavior.
And I'm guessing through all of this research and this behavior model that one could really use this if you're an entrepreneur. Of course, maybe to get in shape and to stop eating maybe so much meat and all those other things personally, but I think maybe the bigger picture is how can one take this model and use it in a way to help or to get other people to change their behavior, i.e. maybe someone has a nonprofit. How can we get them to donate more? Or if I have a website, I really want people to sign up for my newsletter. How can I do that better? And so this model really is a way, it's a formula to really show you how to manipulate these three things, motivation, ability, and triggers, in order to get people to basically start a new behavior.
Exactly. So, you know, from an entrepreneur standpoint, you think, what is the behavior we want people to do? Sign up for our service, launch our app every day, and so on. How do we trigger it? Have we made it simple enough, and so on? Let me name some names of some former students of mine. One of the co-founders of Instagram is a former student of mine. The founder of Pulse, which is a newsreader, it's become very popular, was my teaching assistant last year. One of the students in my class last year started a company called Like a Little, which is not a service I use, but it's taken off. And other students recently started a company called Friendly, friend.ly.
Sure.
And they went from essentially zero users to 6 million unique users in 4 months. So, and all the cases, what they were successfully designing behavior change systems and getting triggering people to do what they wanted to do in order to have a successful company or startup or service.
That's a great sort of record of success from your students. Now, do you also do some consulting for entrepreneurs? Maybe someone's starting a website or has a website, and they really like what they're hearing here, but they want a little bit more of an expert sort of take on things. Would you work with them? Do you do consulting like that?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is yes. There's a way to go to bjfogg.com and book a 15-minute appointment with me. And I do about 60 of these a month.
Wait, how many?
And in those 15, about 60.
60 of them, okay.
Yeah. So 15-minute appointments. It happens Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 1 to 3, boom, boom, boom. And in those 15 minutes, I try to help people as much as I can. Now, I'm not looking for clients. From a consulting perspective, I'm totally booked up. So I really can't become a consultant to your startup. But that's a solution. And I've done this about 2 years now. It's been great fun. I learned stuff. I get to help people, with actually no strings attached. And so that's one way that people can, get me to try to help them for 15 minutes. And there's actually a lot you can get done. And ideally, I try to, for starters, get them to that breakthrough point where they understand what's the behavior that we're trying to achieve. Now, how do we trigger this? And often that points to strategy and business model as well. I don't claim to be the strategy business model guy. But once you get clear about the behavior and how you're triggering it and whose behavior you're triggering, then those other things get clear as well.
Well, that is that is an unbelievable resource that you're offering. So if people go to BJFogg, so that's BJFogg.com, then they can schedule this 15-minute sort of mini consultation with you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really pretty amazing that you do this. And you also have this persuasion boot camp. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. I'm sure that's going to be of interest to some listeners.
So about a year ago, I started what I call persuasion boot camp. It's a 2-day event where 10 people come to my guest home here in California Wine Country. And for 2 days, I teach behavior design, which is, how to think through behavior change and how to design systems, not really for your own, changing your own behavior, but it's companies that come, big brands, entrepreneurs, and so on. And so they're thinking about their behavioral goals for customers, potential customers. So it's 2 days, very hands-on. We all sit around one table, so it's a small group. I love it. It's so fun, and it's great to do it. So I'm doing more of those. I'm doing some on the road, but they only scale so far. So I don't announce them very far in advance, and when I do, they sell out pretty quickly. And so the secret there is, if you want to know about it, there's a advance notification list. So people email me, and then I notify that list, and then that's kind of how it happens.
Okay, and you also have a newsletter that you sign that you send out, correct?
Yeah, from my Stanford lab. So that's the boot camp is what I do outside of Stanford, and then the newsletter summarizes some of the work and some of the things we find interesting in the persuasive technology lab there at Stanford.
And what's the web address for that?
The web address is captology.stanford.edu, and captology is spelled CAPTOLOGY. In some ways, it's easier to go to bjfogg.com from there.
And then just it links over.
Yeah. And there you can get to my Stanford Lab website, and that allows people to sign up for the newsletter, which, of course, is free.
See, we've just decreased the ability here. And more people will sign up as a result. So, and there are, 8 more mistakes that people make when they're trying to change their behavior that I'll write about. Just really such good information here. So, BJ, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insight into this very, very important topic. I really, really appreciated it.
Thanks for having me.